All right, man. Happy New Year.
Yeah, Happy New Year, Charles.
How are you doing?
Yeah, good.
I see you have a new color shirt on.
Yeah, it's blue to match my eyes, you know.
Azure.
Yep. So, well, maybe that's it, yes. Yeah, to just fit in with the new branding.
Very cool. So another episode of Expert to Expert. What's going on?
Okay, well, today we have George here. We're going to talk about concurrency.
Uh-huh. He knows a little bit about concurrency.
Well, we'll find out.
Huh? All right.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, tell me, what is the kind of biggest problem that you see that we're facing today?
Well, it really depends on the application domain and where you're working. So I can't say that any, people working in the software industry all have one big problem.
Wouldn't that be nice?
In some ways it would be nice. It would make things simpler.
I think complexity, right? So what's kind of,
I think complexity is an issue. I think robustness is an issue. And it actually kind of goes down from complexity. I mean, people want to do more and more with software. So the software, just you don't have room. You have to make it more complex. You have to make it, at the same time, more robust, more responsive. There's a lot of things entering the picture that didn't used to enter the picture, like this SLA, this service level agreement in terms of time, not just mean time to failure, but responsiveness. So there's a lot of things that are coming online because we're putting computers everywhere. So I think the major issue is really complexity between distributed systems, between systems that have many components inside, etc.
So complexity, can you explain that a little bit? Because are we making things too complex, or is it just that we're trying to tackle more complex problems?
Well, we do have a tendency, except the mouse in my pocket and me, but the general software engineering, code is easy to write. I mean, code has been easy to write. So we definitely produce a lot more code than our users can consume. So, yeah, we do tend to overcomplicate things, but I don't think actually that's the issue. I think it's the latter, which is we are doing more things. Unfortunately, because software is so easy to do, we tend to produce oogles of lines of code for something that could have been done simpler. But most of the cases, it's just some really hard stuff out there that nobody was asking computers to do. And in my mind, what I'm really interested in is autonomy. I really love autonomy, not just in terms of mobile things, robots, but, software. Software being autonomous for the maximum time.
And so another thing that kind of, comes into my mind when you talk about autonomous is that kind of, software right now is quite brittle. So if something breaks, the whole system goes down. Or if you want to upgrade something, you have to reboot afterwards. So do you have any kind of solutions on how to make software like more dynamic in that sense?
Yeah, but I'm not telling you. That's fine.
Well, if you tell the viewers, that's better.
That's right. Well, in general, when we talk about autonomy, it has many aspects. One of them, of course, is you want to stay operating within some parameters for as long as possible. The other one is you want to improve. So it's one thing to have a piece of software that is very robust to failure. It's another to have a piece of software that one scales. So that's, at least keep constant your behavior as you add users or components. So that's another thing that keeps you autonomous. It prevents people from intervening. So you see, I think of autonomous also in the lifetime of the product. If I can make something that can scale better, for example, it is autonomous in that sense. It keeps performance up. And then when it comes to improvement, it could become adaptive with very, I'm not talking about, 30 years in the future computer science, but some very basic mechanisms that can make things adaptive. And we're doing that. We're doing that in data centers. We're doing that for power management and all that. Now, when it comes to a solution for all this, and I think we're getting kind of to where Charles wants us to get before we go out in the weeds, is I do believe as much as you can get away with, is minimize the core principle, the core things that somebody has to learn. Now, they might be suboptimal for all application domains, and we understand that there's different things that you can use to do better performance or more concise syntax even for a wide range of things, but having a small set of principles, a small set of concepts that somebody can use, think of that as the big hammer. To just approach the problem initially, build something that is loosely coupled, and that's really where it comes in. Everybody talks about loose coupling, but it's loose coupling of people. So I can develop something independently, you can develop something independently, and then it's loose coupling of these components, So when I talk about coordination concurrency, I can literally move the thing, you know, in the cloud or to another machine without changing the way I think about failure, without changing the way I think about concurrency. And in my opinion, most concurrency models fail because they don't distribute and they don't deal about failure. I don't really care if you have, you know, the most optimal way to utilize my cores. I'll have 3,000 maybe one day. And plus, concurrency just happens. There's a lot of distributed things around the world that we can utilize one day. I mean, latency will be there, but that's fine. But failure. If I think of one certain way, then I will not be able to deal with latency being 3 times longer or failure happening on the call, not just the operation itself, but the, you know, the act of invoking something might fail. So if you prepare people to deal in a model, in my opinion, that these things are first principles, it's almost like the worst model of all. It's the most pessimistic model. Everything goes to crap, PG-13 version, all the time. And just have a model that takes that into account. So when you're local, you optimize, you know, the crap out of it. It works as pretty well. But when you're remote, you didn't notice in some sense. You instead of build your algorithms to be adaptive, to be scalable, and to deal with failure. Because that's, in my mind, the big thing.
Okay, so I can relate to this because, you know, often I kind of, you know, in the last, my last couple of talks I've been saying, you know, 50 years of computer science that we have done until now is a complete waste of time because the kind of computational models that we have don't take this into account. They kind of have this idealized world where, you know, everything is nicely compositional, there's no failure, there's no latency and so on.
Right.
So the question is, how do we kind of, you know, move on from where we teach people this kind of, you know, very simple, synchronous, you know, idealized world to the kind of real world where all these things
actually
don't really hold, these assumptions.
Yeah, exactly. And actually, I like the term teach because I think this is where we have to start. It comes to teaching. It's funny, I love robotics. I came into robotics because I really thought this is the only way people are going to get this programming model in mind. You need at least one niche application that really needs this type of model, makes it clear. Because look, with object-oriented programming, with function calling, with shared memory, we're getting that way with a lot of things. So people are like, no, screw you. I'm just going to keep doing what I'm doing. So I went into robotics because, you know, it has the complexity. It has massive message loads. It has the need to be robust to failure. And it has this distribution. It has this need for concurrency. And at the same time, it's just clear if the robot falls off the cliff, you know, yeah. You did something wrong versus a slow live lock that takes, you know, 3 days to run out of resources and then you're just spinning your wheels. Yeah. That applies too, but in any case, so teaching. So how do you teach? First of all, get them engaged into a domain that makes it clear you have to think differently. So I'm not joking. Gaming and robotics. Get people to do games and to do robots. And not do games in traditional while loop of do physics, you know, do AI, render graphics, kick off some audio, repeat. Do gaming in the asynchronous sense, a free-running sense. It almost, you know, applies to processors. We essentially have synchronous processors. They're all clocked because this free-running hardware is extremely hard to debug. But in software, we can actually leapfrog that. We can literally have these data flows, these things that I ask for something, when things happen or failure happens, you just diverge. But you think in that way. You think in execution graphs. And it's actually intuitive to think in execution graphs if you start people doing games or robots. So literally, you know, we talk to hardware guys that make sensors or make hardware, and they get the model that I like, you know, the message data flow model. They just get it. They don't argue with me. They just get it. They love concise syntax. One day languages will have even more concise. I mean, I'm seeing now F# is taking a lot of these principles, choice, data flows, and it's putting it in the language. Great. And I don't care, you know, what the syntax is. I care about the model. And I think people think in terms of interaction. So teach them about games. Teach them about robots, where interaction is a first-class principle. And then it just scales to everything. It scales to 1 million servers in the cloud or 300 little components trying to reach a decision within 1 second, you know, and make something happen. So again, you have to get people interested to think about interaction, to think in this type of model.
But what I often see is that people kind of say, yeah, that's all nice, but then in the end they kind of care more about, like, you know, small-scale performance and so on. They say, well, you know, if I'm doing this kind of little stuff here, I don't want to think like that, you know. I want to kind of optimize for kind of, you know, the fact that, you know, everything is closed by and I want to just do imperative programming.
So
how far does it scale down?
You're absolutely right. So first of all, I love imperative programming. I just freaking love imperative programming, right? But I also like declarative programming, and I don't think they're actually, you know, in contradiction to each other. So underspecify as much as you can. Have the language, the runtime, do as much as you want, and you be at a high level. But at the same time, you know, issue commands as much as you can get away with. So I don't think anymore they're oxymorons, this kind of message passing data flow paradigm with performance. I mean, we have proof. I mean, CCR, for example, compressed down to 25 kilobytes of code, and we know people are running it on hundreds of thousands of machines, having latencies down in the nanoseconds. I mean, we're literally at the thread switch time from managed code. I don't know how to make it any faster, and I don't care, because people literally tell me, well, you know, today we just added two more cores, and sure, you're like slightly sublinear in terms of scaling, but I just scale like 0.99 because I added two more cores and twice as fast almost. So really, we have to look at performance, and you know this, I'm sure. When you get so much into performance, I believe in good enough performance, and I believe in something that is robust enough that will scale, because I know a lot of things that will run really fast, and then I give you 100 million, you know, work items, and you just croak, you fall over. Operating systems do all this time. I queue too many ERPs, for example, in the kernel, things start falling over, or that used to happen. So performance, we have to be very careful. Yeah, I want to optimize something to have minimum latency, and calling a method is, of course, you know, 8 cycles now, whatever it is. But in the long term of things, I am more robust, and I scale. So if you take scaling into account, I don't see how performance, you know, suffers in some sense.
Okay. So then let's kind of talk about, like the mental model, right? Because another thing what makes concurrency hard is the fact that, you know, what people often do is they can, you know, they trace the program in their heads or even with their fingers to understand it. But
and you don't want that, exactly.
Yes. So,
exactly.
So, but how can we kind of comprehend code that's kind of, you know, concurrent and distributed?
Petri-nets.
Just joking.
Colored Petri-nets. Half jokingly, again, it's really about teaching. As you said, people are used into this long-running sequence. So they're used to this thing called, you know, the thread in some sense. It's this logical context, your bag of things, your state. And they literally now have to think about, in a very weird sense, about this arbitrary switching.
Yep.
And in my opinion, it is the programming model itself that confuses you when you start reasoning about your program. So I actually believe it. I mean, I'm a big message-based guy, love task-based parallelism, but I also know that's crap by itself, because if you didn't have this, you know, multitasking, this time-sliced multitasking, things would just be cooperative again, would be 20 years in the past.
Yep.
So I'm actually believing this beautiful world that we are today, which is you have a time-slice system underneath, a general-purpose operating system. On top of that, you put a task-based library that has the right level of isolation for the programmer. So the programmer doesn't need to worry if someone is cooperating properly or not. Now, in terms of the model, as you said, how does the programmer visualizes his program, I think they're in a much better world if they think in terms of data flows, if they think in terms of, you know, dependencies, data dependencies. And let me put it in much more layman's terms.
Mm-hmm.
Before I get to do something on the screen in my WPF application, I need something from the hard drive. That's a data dependency. So we're going back to network diagrams from, you know, 20 years ago. But in some ways, now I'm not saying network diagrams by themselves, because they have this issue about, you know, bifurcation. If something fails, they don't show failure very well. But they do show data flow. They do show that, you know what, I need to do this, and this just cannot happen until this happens. And I don't want to worry about something preempting in here, or getting access to a resource, or protecting that resource to be atomic. So what do? We actually take even the resource access, something that you want to be atomic, to be no more than a request for data. So you now understand that the model of signaling, the model of coordination, the model of protecting resources, the model of messaging, all becomes with one primitive. You can use it with one primitive. You just have to have people to think that if they want to access their shared state, they have to ask for it in some sort of sense.
But isn't that in some sense kind of, you know, completely like 180 degrees how you think right now? Because right now it's like not data flow, it's more like, you know, to do this I need to do that, so the flow kind of goes the other direction.
It is kind of inverse, but it's also natural. I mean, there's two models. There's really just two models when you're in the data flow environment. There's the unsolicited model, think of it as an interrupt model.
Mm-hmm.
So you have a long running process like in the server, something comes in from a client, that is essentially a message that was unsolicited. It just came in, you need to react.
Yep.
This model actually encompasses that very well. Publication subscription systems are that unsolicited model. Mm-hmm. So again, we actually, in the CCR at least, or the things that are now being built from it, you basically say, okay, you have these long-running things that they just completely idle. No power, no CPU, no nothing. Something comes in, you have registered some constraints, declaratively saying, if this and this and this is true, then wake me up. Essentially do pre-processing like our brain does in the visual pathway. Before you even tell me about going to the elevator, I have to pre-process all those things. So it actually works beautifully in the push model, in my opinion. Yeah. Then the other one is the pull model, it's the solicited model. Now I'm going to change views and I'm going to the client, and I'm going to say, I still need a programming model that I can very elegantly go request something, express the data flow of success, failure from the server, or timeout, and then proceed to my next operation or next operation. And again, we can do that as well. One, the first model, the unsolicited model, is basically registering, you know, a receiver on some constraints. Mm-hmm. The other model is you issuing a message on a primitive, like a port, that has N receivers behind it, or N servers. So it's beautifully symmetric in that sense, that you think about timeout, you think about failure, it's just messages. They're not something you do try-catch on, which of course only works in a single thread context. Instead, there's little independent things that can kick off their own little data flows.
But you know, I'm just kind of playing devil's advocate there. But I mean, one of the reasons that people do like try-catch is that there's kind of states that kind of, you know, is maintained. And now if you have to break everything up in little pieces into failure continuation, success continuations.
Exactly.
Now your program kind of goes, and your brain kind of, you know, has to be turned inside out.
You got it. So one of the issues of the data flow model is that because it is a task-driven model and you don't have this continuous thread, this long-lived thread, yeah, you have to drop state around. And more importantly, which I think is very important, is you have to, in your mind, have this spaghetti of continuations. But I don't want to go yet to syntax, because I think we've done things with syntax, and C# has that really helps us these days.
Mm-hmm.
But let's stay at the conceptual model.
Yep.
I think the conceptual model, if somehow manifested in an elegant way in an imperative language, I think the conceptual model is very intuitive for people to understand. They literally draw a bunch of interaction diagrams, and then they try to implement that. So that's the statement I'm making at the highest level.
Okay.
Now, you're right that if I try to manifest that asynchronous message passing whatever model, when it manifests in a modern imperative language, these issues come up, where these short-lived tasks, I have to push parameters to them and all that. So this is where, you know, we did some concrete things. I mean, there's stopgap measures, but we did some concrete things to make that much easier for the developer. So one thing we did, you know, almost 5 years ago when C# was not even, you know, beta, you know, the iterators come out,
mm-hmm.
and we're like, actually, to be honest with you, I didn't understand why we had iterators, except the very first thing that occurred to me was, oh, I can build a scheduler out of this. I mean, it's literally the first thing, somebody had to explain to me, no, dude, this is so you don't return a collection all at once, is you just return an item at a time. Like, oh, this is like 3 years later. Mm-hmm. So what did we do? We just took the iterators in the case of C# and said, you're rewriting this to be a state machine. All the variables are captured to be part of a class. When I write my program, I do very elegant things, in my opinion, like send message, yield to either success or failure. Success manifests as an item in that same continuous context in the iterator. All my stack variables are there. I mean, they're not stack variables anymore, but all my locals are there. Everything's there. So I've lost that big nightmare of continuation passing and pushing parameters. So that literally in the CCR programming was removed. I was in the perfect world of doing things that appear to be synchronous, but I could scale to 300 million asynchronous requests, and the code reads like it's synchronous. So you see, the conceptual model, once again, is now manifesting much better. And I'm not saying, look, this is where we need to end up, but it was just free, and I would argue with anyone that iterators literally well built to do something like that very elegantly and very well.
But isn't there something kind of, you know, deeper kind of going on where, like, if you really look what you're trying to do with iterators is, in some sense, you're trying to do, like, coroutines that were, like, you know, something that people have been talking about since the 50s, and that never kind of really caught on, and now we're trying to kind of, you know, package or implement them in some way using iterators. But
well, you see, people follow the path of least resistance, in my opinion. So it's really about timing. a lot of people can make the argument that, you know, if you come with a very good technology when there is no really the need, the pain for it, it won't catch on. So I don't think this message passing idea is bad or hasn't caught on. It has caught on massively on the server side, of course. Mm-hmm. We know that. There is no alternative. But it's because there was no need. Now, I think, concurrency being just one of the drivers, I think, you know, failure, coordination being other drivers, people are saying, well, let's give this another go. All right? I think we've matured. We've learned. There's a lot of syntactic sugar and a lot of compiler, you know, mechanisms now that make this a lot easier. Anonymous methods is a very good example of this auto capture that we don't have to do anymore. And this is another example where the timing is just, it's just getting there, in my opinion. That, again, in my opinion, you will see that people are like, oh my God, why don't we just do things this way? And then somebody will come and say, no, you had this 50 years ago. And then someone else will say, no, I didn't, because I didn't have the compilers, I didn't have all these tricks. So I really believe it's a matter of timing. I don't think we're pushing anything hard. I think it is natural. It is just that for other reasons, we're now putting things in place that will make this imperative, asynchronous, coordination-driven programming model be natural. And I think that's where we're going.
Okay, and so can we talk a little bit more about coordination? Because one of the kind of hard things is, right, if I have, like, you know, several kind of messages coming in, how do I kind of, you know, pattern match on them, or exactly. How do I kind of, you know, coordinate and say, you know, if these come in, then I want to do this. So, so can you tell a little bit more about how you kind of, you know, see that?
So what I've been saying for quite some time is that I never was interested in concurrency per se at all. I was interested in coordination, because if I enable coordination, that enables concurrency.
Yep.
And it actually goes back to failure. A lot of times people do, you know, read file, then render, or read file, then read database, because they're just scared, as you said, to coordinate the combinatorial explosion of failure successes.
Yep.
So what we thought hard about is to take some of those common patterns. One, a very common pattern is wait for multiple. You know, Unix, Windows had it for many years. So you throw a lot of things out there. Any order, when all of them are done, atomically, you just get called and says, things are ready for you. However, the pattern sucks, because you have to go piecewise now, using like an integer to index your events, and determine which one was failure, which one wasn't failure. So it's really, really crap. People did more harm to themselves doing the wrong event or dealing with something as failure when it was success than if they had done things sequentially. Again, it's a matter of timing. So what we did is, we said, okay, so I'm going to give you an intelligent dynamic join, a dynamic wait for multiple that is strongly typed. So we added this one-line thing that basically does the following. You give me a port that has two subqueues. Our ports are typed, and you can have, for example, an int and a string. And you say, I expect a total of k messages spread in some random combination between strings and ints. We have one primitive. You say, you know, join on this, int and strings, but a total of k. When I receive a total of k, I will call you with two collections, typed. One collection will have m ints, the other one will have n strings. Now, if this was successes, failures, imagine how I trivialize this, and I'm talking about now millions of requests outside. I'm not talking about a toy. People do this right now. They issue 1,000 requests as fast as they can. Things are happening concurrently, out of order. I'm not waiting for the slowest guy. Literally, I'm leveraging latency. So things are happening concurrent, and then I call you once with two bags. One bag that has all your successes, and one bag that has all your failures. So this is an example of a very simple primitive that, by the way, I didn't change anything in the core runtime. The core runtime has a little algebra of composition. You can basically take, you know, a join and put it under a choice, and you can take a choice and put it under a join, and all that. So it was very easy to extend because of this little algebra that basically you call your parent and says, should I commit? So it has this little two-phase commit. And now I can have these very concise little primitives, and users of the CCR are writing their own, by the way. People have, for example, have little inline link queue, link expressions as the receiver is running in the first phase of the receiver, and they do filtering and all that, and then they call you. So they compresses massively all these coordination patterns, and it's more robust. I literally don't forget about failure. Many times, you know, people do try catch, fall into the floor. Here it's like in your face, you know, you have a little slot, and it's very elegant. You can say, I don't care if it's the first failure. For example, we have patterns that tell you on first failure, or we have on all failures, wait for all of them. So all these patterns are encapsulated very concisely in C# or VB, because none of them require iterators and all that. And there you go. This is an example of you build on a core little engine, and you make it expressive only to the degree that I can describe coordination primitives, and you go from there.
So here's another question there. It's like, you know, in some sense there's a kind of, you know, if you read the old literature on object orientation, people talk about, like, you know, sending messages to objects and so on. And in the CCR you have the kind of, you know, this notion of a port. Shouldn't objects and ports, shouldn't that be just the same? Shouldn't objects just be kind of things you're sending messages to? Or,
well, there's a massive, superficially they do look similar, but there's massive issues when you start digging deeper. One issue is, how much isolation do you want in data, and how much isolation do you want in execution context? One thing we do in our distributed runtime DSS that we built on top is we isolate you in both data, and we isolate you in, essentially, time. So, for example, if you throw an exception in the callee, so let's say we have an object and we send it a message. It doesn't have to reply to us directly. Mm-hmm. But whose execution context is that object using to do the calculation? Whose stack is it allocating on? What is it corrupting and all that? So we're very careful to think about that. And unfortunately, because I think of the way objects have been used in this synchronous sense, in this context of imperative languages, I cannot safely use the term class or object and give you the degree of isolation the CCR gives you. So I do a jump. I say, forget it. You just don't even know who's going to be receiving this message. All you see is this token, this port, that can have one receiver or 10 receivers. They can come and go dynamically, as a matter of fact, which an object was never meant to do. You can't have methods come and go, right?
Well, it depends on what language you're using.
I think we're stretching it versus the common usage.
Yeah.
But this dynamic message-based programming, this was always natural. Like, a server doesn't know how many clients at any given time are connected, but it deals with that in a beautiful way because it's loosely coupled. So when I talk about loose coupling, I mean that you have to start thinking about objects. I mean, look, people can claim objects can do everything, but no, they were really not well thought out in some sense. They can do a lot of things, and they gave us, you know, a certain degree of composition, but now it's time to move ahead and not trying to say this is an object. We need to say this is something that isolates you in data. So, for example, we at compile time analyze your code and build little cloners at compile time that can very efficiently, you know, change your data when you send messages. And you can opt in, of course. I'm C#. I'm not, you know, a language that has no side effecting, like, you know, purely functional language. And I'm not, by the way, I don't want to go into that because I'm not big on functional languages, but I do believe when you want to have the choice of no side effecting, you know, static single assignment for messaging, that's gorgeous. So what did we do? We did it at runtime. With some compile time support, when you send a message, you can literally modify a value right after, and it will not be visible to the receiver or end receivers. So this is why I'm saying it's not easy to jump from object to this, people call it agent model or message passing model. You have to think of isolation as a first class principle. Not just data, but execution context.
Okay, but then, like, I just like to kind of, you know, drill down a little bit deeper here, because, you know, I think this is like a very interesting kind of, you know, tension between the two. Because, like, for example, one of the things that objects give you is also something like implementation inheritance, where, you know, you can have some kind of behavior and then I can specialize that. Whereas now, if you go to some other model, now it seems that you have to kind of simulate a lot of that that kind of reuse.
It's actually a very interesting question, because one of the first, in a service model or an agent model, that's what people always ask is, how in the world do I reuse, right? The gorgeous thing, actually, I think, in message passing models is that I can get true reuse. Now, let's think about a base inheritance, you know, an inheritance in an object model. What are the concurrence implications when you do that? They're very ill-defined. Extremely ill-defined.
Yeah, I agree with that.
So you're saying that you're getting inheritance and reuse, but no, you are not. You're only getting it to a trivial degree, in my opinion. Now go a little bit further and talk about real reuse, where I deploy a component that I want to be running 24/7 that has V1, version 1 functionality, and then I want to add incrementally some extra functionality without taking that down, or even making users aware that have expanded if they don't need to know. In a service, you know, system, in a messaging system, if I have a URI in front, and I can say, well, you know, if you're a V1 client, I can redirect messages to the long-running agent that knows about V1. Now, the V2 client, this is the one that wants the reusability, wants to get the V1 functionality and the V2 functionality, right? Well, he gets a different URI, a different, you know, port. where half the messages are redirected to the running agent that does V1, so I didn't have to re-implement anything, and it's truly concurrent. It's truly isolated in failure. And then two or three messages go to what? To my new guy. We've taken that model, we have a versioning model, and we use this in robotics, because, you know, sensors come and go and all that, to literally give you that massive level of reuse and concurrency. Like clear concurrency semantics, where you know your base class is modifying some common state concurrently or exclusively to you.
But what happens there? But when you, because now you're doing kind of delegation in some sense, right? But what happens now if the one of your methods kind of sends back the itself, right? It bored now. Don't you get into the
classic problems
with delegation there?
Absolutely. First of all, we don't pass delegates around, but we pass our ports. So I send you a message. In that message, I have another port. I mean, this is where, you know, the mobile process algebras come in, which, by the way, I don't think they can ever work. They're unimplementable. But they do have some elegant concepts, which is, if I want to learn something from you, symmetrically, I'm going to give you another port that is scoped to only understand your response. So it's private in some sense. So I didn't delegate anything about my locality. This is why this is gorgeous. This is why this is mobile. I only delegated a proxy to my locality, not even a method, because we know methods have massive implications. Are they static? Are they instance? All of that. No. I just gave you essentially what I think objects would be used for. The only thing I think your object's being useful is to implement a port. It's an opaque, thread-safe thing, a bag of items that completely hides where and when the actual delegate executes. So there is no problem with delegation. I have this running. I mean, literally, when it goes across boundaries, you have a URI instead of a port. When you're local, I even traverse efficiently without thread switching, and I just deliver an item on a method. But to you, it's a port. You're expecting latency. You're expecting the message to not even get there. Not even the message getting there and getting failure. You're expecting the model allows for you to not even get there. So there is no delegation issues if, again, you normalize to not pass GUIDs, tokens, whatever. Use, in distributed setting, use the URI scheme, which is powerful, it's useful. And in the local setting, it's all manifested through a little port. Post, O1, always constant time, and then the ability to attach random receivers.
Okay, so let's kind of drill down a little bit deeper and kind of, you mentioned this kind of algebra, right? So can we talk a little bit more, so like what kind of, you know, are the kind of typical operators in this algebra?
Yeah.
And like, probably also, you know, what are the kind of design patterns that you kind of see kind of, you know, appearing there, and this kind of things that people tend to use a lot.
Absolutely. The design patterns, that's really what's gorgeous, is that you're starting to see this very neat design patterns that, first of all, capture the time domain, so rate-based stuff, and they also capture very interesting, I think, failure or resource access patterns. So in terms of the CCR, I'm not going to talk about the mobile algebra. Mm-hmm. They have a very limited set. It looks deceivingly concise, but then when you try to do verbose programs, it explodes. But in the CCR case, what we basically say is that you have the ability to attach a two-phase receiver to any port. What that means is that you have the requester and the guy that implements the request. That is the receiver. This is a piece of code you write in VB or C# as a handler. But you annotate, you wrap that with what I call an arbiter, the thing that arbitrates when you wake up. Now, the algebra comes into play on how do you decide to arbitrate. Do you run, and you run once for every message? Do you stay on the port? If there's 1,000 messages, you run 1,000 times concurrently. This is the easiest source of concurrency in the CCR. Mm-hmm. You attach one receiver, you say persist. If there's 1,000 messages and there's 1,000 cores, it will literally run 1,000 times concurrent. So, you know, that's some of the algebra starts. The other thing you start thinking about is, well, let's start coordinating between them. So what I described so far is kind of like a pairwise interaction. Mm-hmm. Most usually what you have is you have multiple elements playing and possibly listening on the same port. So for example, you have someone that's interested in message A and another one interested in message B. However, they have this relationship. For example, the handler for message A can only run if there is no other handler anywhere in that locality running on that port, and also no instances of itself. So if there were two message handler A's running, because for example they're touching common state, that's bad doo-doo. So this is where the second pattern, or series of pattern emerges, is coordination across these listeners. And this is where we have the interleave pattern. At the most basic sense, you can think of it as a reader-writer, but it isn't because there are no locks involved. Mm-hmm. Instead, it's a data flow dependency scheduler. It basically has a bunch of queues.
he notices that you have declared, literally declared, this thing to be exclusive. If it's an iterator, by the way, and it has multiple asynchronous steps, you are protected across all those state transitions, which is much more powerful than just having a lock around a method. It literally has a state machine, and it says, using just one tri-state variable, oh, an exclusive guy is running, everybody else naturally queues up. When the guy is done, essentially the floodgates open. If there are more exclusive guys, they run in priority. Otherwise, the concurrent guys literally just flood the system, use all available cores. So in a very, I think, concise way, I have this little algebra that says, on top of this port receiver principle, build a second level, which is interleave, choice, join. They're all second level primitives. And then decide what is the most common. I'm not going to kind of put all the patterns I see in my head. I'm just going to put the minimal ones there. And that's what we've done. So some other ones are the joins, of course. There is the static joins, which are very common, which is, you know, a priori, I have a string and an int. So you put a receiver that only wakes up when you get both any order. Very powerful, but in my opinion, very limited use. You almost never know at compile time how many things of anything you're going to get. So instead, from the very start, we have this dynamic joins, where you give me a number, and then you give me a set of types, and then I basically either have across one type or across all the types, and I wake up when I get all of them. So these dynamic joins. That's it. Now, the other thing we did from the very beginning is time, you know, signaling. A lot of people said, well, you know what, many times you don't hear back because transient failure or whatever. So I wanted to have a very elegant way to incorporate the way you deal with timeout in the same exact way that you deal with any other message. So I built a little, essentially, process built in within the scheduler that deposits time signals as messages. So you give me a port, just like you would have given me a port for me to reply if I've got the message. But you give me a port to receive a time signal with a timestamp saying you've expired. So now, based on the algebra I just described, all I need to do is choice. Yeah. I say success, failure, or a time signal, or a cancel signal. I mean, that's the other thing that this infrastructure is just gorgeous about, is cancel. I don't know how much familiarity you have with like teardown or cancel, but literally I can spend a lifetime doing a proper cancel. And this makes it so elegant. I think this is where you see the mature runtimes versus the kind of like the early thinking is, somebody can easily give you a continuation passing style that does success failure, and then you say, okay, compose this with a cancel. And they kind of look at you, and they do it like where they do in every possible outcome, they put the cancel there, or they put it up front, and it gets really messy really fast. In this one, you just literally, or the cancel, you or the timeout. You can even do things like smoothing, MPEG smoothing. You can have a port that receives video signals, right? Video images as a byte array. Now, you don't want to have bursty behavior. You literally want to display them once every 30 milliseconds. In the CCR, you do a join between a port that receives a timer message every 30 milliseconds and your bursty pipe that receives N messages. The join smooths that out because it's what? It's you need to have two in any order. Yeah. So you see, I just did smoothing just by doing a little join with a timer. The other thing we did recently is that we did an algorithm that uses your cores to minimize latency. So in Windows right now, to get an accurate timer sub 1 millisecond, you really have to do like full cavity search, I like to call it. Instead, I basically, the algorithm, the way it works, it's embedded in the scheduler. The more cores you add, asymptotically, the latency or the jitter goes down. So now we can do, you know, microsecond type accurate timers with very small jitter by having the processors compete to receive a signal. Because basically they all wake up. You know, it's kind of like work stealing, but they all wake up and they say, oh, I won. So the chance of having somebody doing like a CPU intensive procedure and not be able to do the timeout becomes smaller and smaller as you add cores. So now in user mode, we have a sub-millisecond accurate timer in .NET that leverages your cores.
Wow.
But it's the same concept. It's the same principle. It just composes really naturally that way.
Okay, and then, so if you look at Erlang, right, where people come, you know, one of the interesting things there is that they have kind of, you know, libraries with very high level kind of design patterns, right, where, you know, things with failure, you know, so where they have like, you know, some process monitoring, another one, if it goes down, it restarts. Do you have libraries like that too that kind of, you know, move beyond the kind of, you know,
absolutely,
let's say the kind of low level
absolutely
kind of patterns?
This is where I kind of, I like Erlang was ahead of its time in many ways, and I like what they tried to cram in there, but this is where I actually start also objecting, is how much you're cramming into something like that. So what we did is we kept the CCR small. We gave you those mm-hmm minimal primitives. And then we built this distributed runtime. This is really where you write your service components, you know, DSS, that now has things like that. They monitor failure. They can do logging, very natural logging. Everything's normalized to be messages, so I can capture everything, put it into SQL, and see these beautiful graphs, right? So that's where we built this runtime, to have these additional components for instrumentation, for diagnostics, for failure, for time synchronization. And again, the runtime components built themselves using the CCR, all normalized in that sense. And I think it actually ends up being this really nice little ecosystem that you use C#, you use VB, but you've normalized everyone to deal with ports, messages, and interleaves, and then you have these components come and go that give you that extra functionality. The one thing, as I'm rambling on, is in terms of failure, we did something else as well. We have causalities, the notion of causal flows. And this is kind of an old concept in message-oriented patterns, but it hasn't been realized, in my opinion. I mean, Erlang kind of has it, but what we have is the notion that as you have these execution graphs kind of start and come and go, so I send you a message, you send a message to two other guys without me ever knowing. Mm-hmm. You might even change the pattern dynamically. What happens with failure? What happens if you were not conscious enough to do this or with a timeout or to deal with the failure message? You live lock, essentially, right? You didn't block any thread, but you live lock. You're never going to come back to me. So we have this concept of a causality, which basically, essentially, goes and attaches this logical context. Like, you can implement transactions, for example, on top of causalities, but they are not transactions. They're just this logical context that flows with messages, not with threads, nothing like that. It flows implicit with a message, and it has the notion of a root cause that you can attach a port for failure handling. So imagine this massive execution graph, things happening even across machines. Something goes wrong. You can deal with it at the level that failure makes sense, like a try-catch, but a try-catch across asynchronous trees. And that's what we have. That really, I think, makes it, puts, you know, the super topping on top and lets people not even do this pairwise request, wait for success failure. You don't even need to do that anymore.
So, George, I want to ask a question now in the sense that this was actually brought up on Channel 9. It doesn't seem as though a lot of people are actually adopting the CCR. Mm-hmm. So, sure, MySpace is doing some radical things on their server infrastructure that you never expected them to do, mm-hmm, and it's kicking ass. Mm-hmm. But the average, like, imperative, object-oriented type of developer that Eric helped create, I'm just kidding, you know, that we... That Eric represents, not really. But, you know, my question is, what's going on?
So
what's
actually,
so hard about this conceptual shift?
I don't think it's... even the responses you see is not that people think that it's conceptually hard. Mm-hmm. Many times I think it... And this happens with Erlang itself, in my opinion. It's like, why isn't it everywhere? It has like 5 nines availability. And in terms of syntax, it's actually mm-hmm very elegant. Yeah. Why didn't that get adopted by everyone?
I don't know.
Well, I'll tell you. There's always the business marketing side, and there's always the technical side. Mm-hmm. Now, there's definitely technical barriers for something like the CCR. If you just are not willing to think in this sense, it might not be the right thing for you. Or if you're happy at the level of complexity you're dealing with, to deal with you reinventing a little queue just to get things done, mm-hmm, you're happy. But it really has to do with mainstream. Look, you realize that out of the 330,000 downloads that we've had, mm-hmm, of the CCR, which is not a small number.
Sure.
None of those were done through official Microsoft channels. We never advertised the CCR once. The first time we did it is 3 months ago when we delivered its own product because it was solid, it was robust, we made it into our own little library so we can get some money. Everything has been under robotics. It's been Channel 9 and robotics.
Exactly.
There has been no mainline Microsoft guy telling you, hey, this comes with Visual Studio, here it is. Mm-hmm. Now, we're working towards that. We're working on putting something like this in .NET in some dev 11, 12, 13,
who knows.
But when that happens, and this is really the other huge part of the equation, when you put it in front of people, you have the right documentation, you have the marketing, you have things become a lot more popular. But right now, in terms of marketing dollars spent versus adoption by, you know, Siemens, Tyco, MySpace, whoever, mm-hmm, it's a really big hit in that sense. Mm-hmm. So that's why we're working with the dev guys to put it in front of people, integrate it with the, you know, the BCL and all that. So then you don't think twice about going here, downloading this DLL and all that. It will be integrated as part of the family. Mm-hmm. Unless you do this as a Microsoft or something big, these technologies are not going to just magically... It's same with Erlang. If we were, for example, the ones pushing Erlang, mm-hmm. or there was another company in the business doing it, it wasn't like a telco.
Yeah, well, we've had this conversation, like Eric, many, many times in the great interviews we've done in JAO, and even on camera and off camera amongst your fellow, you know, language geniuses that we've had this conversation with. I still don't, I mean, there still needs to be something. I mean, PHP, for example, is the most widely used programming language on the web. That didn't have a huge amount of marketing. There was no one single company behind it, pimping it everywhere. So, I mean, there has to be something to the notion of complexity, of simplicity.
You're right, but again, based on the number of downloads and usage cases we're getting, I really think we're seeing that without no marketing money...
Agreed.
We're getting that. But to go to the next level, you need two things. You need some way to get to the mass developer. And look, PHP or Java had different ways of doing that. Mm-hmm. Sure, somebody hit a sweet spot. But then once that sweet spot was hit, there were avenues, there were venues for the open source community to go discover that, use it, iterate on it in an elegant, nice way. Now, as Microsoft, we don't have to go that route. We don't have to just keep putting stuff up in a Channel 9 and Code Project, right? Code Project. We have better mechanisms.
Sure.
So our opportunity, like C-Sharp. C-Sharp became very popular because we did our damnedest to integrate it well, make it a first-class customer, make the transition smoother, do everything you need to do to make it part of the loved ecosystem of languages. Mm-hmm. We will have to do something similar when it comes to application models, programming models.
And one of those things, if I just may, one last mm-hmm. random thing, one of those things that made C-Sharp so readily possible was the similarity in the syntax to a few other languages that were already very popular.
Yep.
And I'm not dissing C-Sharp, by the way, for the record, but that definitely has something to do with it.
Absolutely.
You know, if somebody like Eric came along and like said, let's make Haskell a first-class citizen of .NET and ship it in .NET 1.0, I think that would be that would have had a little less...
But I think you're making a little mistake here, because you equate big use with importance. But maybe there's just like a few specialists that write these kind of really critical, highly concurrent programs, whereas the masses, I mean, it's just like, you know, when you do home improvement, right? You know, people can, you know, normal people can do simple things, but they don't use the kind of, you know, power tools or shovels or whatever. So I think even in programming, there's this distinction between, like, you know, the home user or the kind of, you know, casual user and the real professional that is doing stuff inside the data center.
Now, I have to be careful here, because most of the people that I'm aware, a lot of the people, the masses, use it in the client. They use it to do things like WPF. They use it to do things, you know, everyday software. I don't think this is something for it's very aligned for server and middleware and all that. Because, look, we gave people events in C# and .NET. Mm-hmm. And right now, I don't even know how to coordinate two events. We also gave them the APM pattern. We also gave them semaphores. We also gave them logs. We also gave them all that stuff. And I cannot, in true conscience, say that this stuff we expect the hobbyist to use to make a program.
But most hobbyists won't use that, right?
What do they use to basically create any type of intelligent UI? Background worker? I mean, we have put people in a bind. We say, no, messaging is hard. But we've given you messaging three different ways. We gave you multicast delegates, we've given you, you know, events, we've given you semaphores, we've given you all this stuff. Mm-hmm. And people have to use it every day. We can't keep hiding behind, you know, no, the server programmer has to have this huge throughput. No, the guy that's coordinating disk with UI and network needs something like this.
But I would definitely not kind of, you know, view that person as the kind of casual user. I mean, where I'm thinking more at somebody that's writing, you know, Excel macros or things like that.
Is that most of our programmers writing Excel macros?
I'm not talking here about, again, you know, I don't want to make the mistake of taking, like, you know, numbers, but I think there's different categories of programmers. And
sure.
I think for a lot of code, you know, those things are details that you don't have to deal with. Mm-hmm. And there's other pieces of code where you do have to deal with it. And you know, so that is, I think, where we
have to
be
careful. Though networking now is a first-class citizen. I think we as Microsoft made that mistake. We've lost, in some sense, the battle. Now we're back into it, trying to tell people, oh, network programming, that's not on the fringe anymore. That's every day. When I build my Silverlight application, even there, I have to coordinate between multiple asynchronous requests, doing the most basic HTML rendering. I mean, right now, the live guys, the profiling guys in Windows, they're using the CCR to run a huge part of our backend for Windows Live pages. They're rendering them in ASP.NET using CCR. Yeah, you're going to say this is kind of an edge developer, but you know what? The number of ASP.NET or JavaScript or whatever developers probably outnumbers, you know, as a whole to the guys doing little WinForm apps. Sure. So it's now becoming this network message-oriented or whatever coordination, it's becoming mainstream. We can't hide behind it anymore. You're right that there's different classes. I'm just saying that class that needs coordination is a big
class. How do you make this the notion of concurrency and parallelism more simple? So the crux of the problem, and the reason there is a PCP team, and this is not the drug, parallel computing platform team, is because there is this giant problem, right? So someday there's probably going to be a million cores. So you have applications today can't take advantage of
it. It's not about concurrency, though. Again, it's about coordination. It really is.
I understand. Okay.
Some of them need concurrency. Like if I do ray tracing until I'm blue in the face and all that, I'll use cores. But those are the people that I think you're talking about. Mm. There's people that have been doing this incredible photon, mappers and ray tracers with elegant concurrency for a long time. Mm-hmm. Is that what we want the masses to be? No. We want the masses to deal with failure. We want the masses to write a robust program. So really, Charles, I know this is just basic, maybe a disagreement, but I really do think that if people start thinking about the way they interact with other people, the way they interact with other machines, they start programming that way,
understood.
This will become easy. This will become natural. Visual languages, to some extent, will help. They have a level where they stop scaling. Mm-hmm. But graphical languages can also help. So this is an example, I think, which is a very good example. So when we create a robot, we don't want you to build everything for the robot. You'll just go mad. Like a high-level autonomous planner based on vision, we don't want you doing that. Maybe you can just focus on a very basic, obstacle avoidance. Mm-hmm. So how do you separate those scales of complexity? So what we did is we have this visual language that is basically a manifestation of DSS and CCR visually. And it looks like workflow, but it's really just a data flow language. And you know what? If you want to do a rapid prototyping, you want to put up a component on your designer and you want to request a message or subscribe to a notification, this is how you do it. You do it visually. You bring this guy, drag a wire, and now you're literally listening for pings from the IR. Or you're listening for messages from the network telling you, your payload is ready. So this is where I think this message paradigm has to have these different scales. You can use graphic designers. You can use tools to bring you in the original prototyping stage. And then is when you see the speciation. The guy is writing the link arbiters on top of CCR, or the guy is running the ultra concurrent massive, join.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But in terms of the most basic idea, I still think it's data flow. I still think it's coordination.
Yeah. What do you think about that, Eric?
Well, I think there's certainly some truth in it. Even if you look at people are building mashups, for example, right? Which are things pulling stuff from the web, that can fail, that come in, there's latency and so on. And currently the mashups are quite limited because there's not a lot of coordination between them. But if you want to make them useful, instead of having just little pictures that are independent on your screen, if you really want to leverage them, then you definitely need to kind of coordinate.
Mashups is a huge bit. Yes. I mean, it's lots of developers. We did a mashup based on CCR running in IE 4 years ago. But again, we're not part of Microsoft. We can't tell
us. You're part of Microsoft.
No, we're not part of DevDiv in terms of...
Understood.
Well, sometimes, yeah. That doesn't really matter. It's okay. I think you need people in some sense on the outside, working with people on the inside of the product group. You cannot scale if you have everyone.
Sure.
But we have those examples. The mashups, I think, is very critical. This is why my hope is that when you have CCR integrated, kind of beautified, simplified as necessary, mm-hmm. then people there will start using it and we'll see more.
And maybe this is a nice kind of way to conclude, and also a nice way maybe we can bring this to the masses. It's just saying it's like everything is a mashup that needs to kind of, communicate with each other. So
I think it's better when you say it. I've been saying it, it's nobody gets it because I just flail my arms. And
So
we'll say it again.
There you go.
Instead of coordination, we should talk about mashups.
Yes.
Programming by doing mashups.
Yes.
I think that is a good mental model that people might, have an easier time to understand because it's more familiar.
I agree.
Absolutely.
And coordination becomes a key there instead of thinking about concurrency and using the cores.
Yeah.
Excellent. Hey, great. This is fun. Just been a blast watching you guys talk, as listening to you as well. It sounds as though what you're saying is to not think about concurrency explicitly. That's unnecessary. It's an unnecessary level of abstraction. Think about coordination.
Think about your problem.
Got it.
Think about your damn problem.
Okay, but maybe we are, but remember, when people think about what we've been showing them, and maybe Channel 9 is partly to blame for feeding their frenzy, I don't think so, personally, but you know, there is a concurrency problem. The fact of the matter is, apps that were written today are not going to scale to many core unless things are changed, and for the C++ people out there, and there are many of them, Office is not going to scale to a million cores unless they actually rewrite code.
Look, and you might not need to. What would like Office to scale is just a couple of cores or three cores, so it can be responsive to a few things. Mm. I really think it's based on the problem. We're kind of overhyping, in my mind, this concurrency thing.
Okay.
And kind of freaking people out, where people that have a problem already have solved it. They just have to write the code again and again.
Plus, you know, dealing with failure and so on has nothing to do with concurrency.
Yes, exactly.
I mean, you don't want even like a single threaded program to kind of kind of fail if something breaks, right?
We didn't even talk about quorum-based models, which I love, where you have voting. Your whole software is based on voting. Three out of four components fail, you still go on. We didn't even touch that. Mm-hmm. This is the types of things you talk about, high-level patterns. Blackboard schemes, the thing that, you know, Siemens did to in real-time process mail. Uh-huh. They have multiple agents giving ideas of what this piece of mail says, and they're competing with each other, and they're so robust. Like 30%, 40% of them can die or live lock, and you keep going. This is what we need to be talking about. We need to be talking about new programming, new application models.
Yes.
Not concurrency.
Okay.
Application models where you deal with failure. You expect it. You just have redundancy. You just have a way to deal with scatter gather. You have a way to deal with timeouts, with failure. Hmm. That's what matters, not concurrency. Hmm. Concurrency happens. It just happens.
I'm going to get a bumper sticker that says that.
Yeah. My example there is always, if you know, if you cut off my leg, I can still function. But it's not concurrency, right? It's because I can deal with failure. So it's
redundancy.
It's all these other things.
Yep.
Marvelous. Well, hey, thank you guys.
Okay, you're welcome.
Another awesome episode of Expert to Expert. Great to see you again, George.
Okay.
We'll come back.
Oh.
So beware.
Thanks.
Cheers.
All right.